There may be other questions or things folks would like to point out on that map as well, but just to introduce myself and my organization a little bit and explain how we're involved in this. I'm John Sisk, and I'm the director of SEAC, which is the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council. And SEAC is kind of Southeast Alaska's homespun environmental group. We're a coalition of 15 local volunteer groups. So we have a few paid staff here in Juneau. Been around for about 22 years, and our primary focus is on the management and protection of fish and wildlife habitat on federal and state lands in the Panhandle. We've worked a lot over the years with commercial fishing industry. In fact, a lot of our members are commercial fishermen or crew, and that's one of the reasons that we've taken a somewhat different position on Glacier Bay fishing than a lot of the national environmental groups have. In a nutshell, I guess our membership is really composed of folks who work here and live here, and we really believe that commercial fishing is a real cornerstone of renewable economics in the Panhandle and has to be part of that, and that also that it's, as managed now, it's completely compatible with the kinds of habitat and environmental quality goals that we're striving to protect and to achieve in the future and secure as well. Because of this, SEAC has, as soon as these kinds of conflicts became evident, I think in 1980 a lot of this kind of got past a number of us, and a lot of us didn't realize what was going on, and it really took us by surprise when the Park Service announced that they were going to have to restrict commercial fishing and subsistence in Glacier Bay and a lot of these waters. And it also took us by surprise when the environmentalist lawsuit was filed and included those same issues. Throughout, SEAC has adopted a position of trying to get parties together and arrive at some sort of a solution to this that folks can live with and that honors the economic and subsistence needs of folks who live here. Through a lot of debates, our board of directors, which sets policy for us, it's about 30 people from around the Panhandle, decided to take four formal positions on the places that we could actually achieve consensus. And I just want to summarize those briefly for you. And since they are consensus positions that were reached after about a year and a half of debate, I'll just read them in summary. The first one is that SEAC supports customary and traditional subsistence fishing in the waters of Glacier Bay National Park by the villages of Hoona and Yakutat. Second, that SEAC supports commercial fishing and sport fishing on the outer coast of Glacier Bay National Park and in all icy strait waters, consistent with the maintenance of park values. Third, is that SEAC believes strongly that motorless marine wilderness waters must be maintained and protected in Glacier Bay National Park. And finally, SEAC also believes strongly that there should be no increases in the number of large cruise ship entries into Glacier Bay proper. There are a lot of other issues involved in this and that are debated in legislation in Congress last year, and I'm sure will come up this year, that we did not have a consensus position on. It's kind of funny because one of the reasons we didn't is because a lot of the commercial fishermen on our board didn't necessarily agree on what to do in all parts of it. But we are working as closely as we possibly can with subsistence and fishing interests, as well as trying to be a bridge with the national environmental community to try to help get parties together to understand each other and come up with some kind of a solution. Along those lines, in 1989 and 1990, SEAC convened a gathering called the Glacier Bay Citizen Caucus, which was an attempt to get a lot of the environmental and fishing interests in the Northern Panhandle together in Hoona, and in some meetings that followed up, to see what kind of a compromise might be possible. And there was a lot of support from Sea Alaska, a lot of support from Hoona residents and from the fishermen in pursuing that kind of a direction. There was not a consensus position, but there was a surprising amount of progress made, and I brought along copies of my hearing statement to the House of Representatives last year, which summarizes both CX consensus positions and the kind of the tentative rough cut at a compromise that the caucus came up with, but the principles of that were that Glacier Bay National Park and Preserve should be managed in such a manner that will leave its resources unimpaired, but not necessarily unused, for present and future generations. And that within this mandate, historical, customary, and traditional uses by local citizens shall be allowed. And those were kind of the guiding themes. And it was an attempt to basically honor the continuing fishing uses, respect the values of the park, and provide some protected areas for park visitors as well, and try to merge all those together. I honestly don't know where this issue is going to head from here, but I think that from our viewpoint, we can do a certain amount of advocacy on this issue on behalf of Alaskans, and then we run into a place where we have to basically kind of slow down and just try to get folks together. And it may be that perhaps one of the things that our organization can do is to continue to try to work with folks here to try to communicate with national environmental interests, with some of the folks in the Clinton administration, and try to get them to understand the fishing interests a little more and subsistence, and see if we can't work something out this time around. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Sisk. Any questions, sir? Representative Davidson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a quick question. You talked about your efforts with the national environmental community. Has there been any success with your people sitting down with members of the Sierra Club and pounding out some of these differences that you can have the opportunity to educate them about the local situation?
There has been some. One of the problems is that a lot of the national environmental groups don't necessarily have consensus on this issue themselves internally. There is a process of review going on within the Sierra Club, and I'm actually not sure what the status of that is, but they're taking a hard look at it because I think everybody agrees that things didn't turn out in Congress last year the way that anybody had hoped they would. It was this Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt likes to use the analogy of a train wreck, but that's kind of the way I think we felt about it. It looked for a minute like we were going to solve something, and then it all came apart at the seams. But I know most of these groups are taking a look at what happened last year and trying to figure out internally what they want to do this year. And there's only so much we can do until they've kind of gone through that process. But luckily, we're getting started early in this Congress, which is probably the best thing about it. One of our big problems last year was it didn't really build up any steam in the House or the Senate until the 11th hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
At this time, we'll take a 5-minute break and start off with the Marine Mammal Protection Act.
There is one right there.
I'd like to bring the meeting back to order. And at this time, we're supposed to take up the Marine Mammal Protection Act, and we'd like to go to Susan Luzicello on teleconference in Washington, D.C. Go ahead, Susan.
Good morning. I'm Ms. Suzanne Giudicello. I'm with the Center for Marine Conservation, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I was asked to discuss generally the Marine Mammal Protection Act. What I'd like to do is cut the generic remarks pretty short, because I know you're running behind time, and Mr. Moore from Congressman Young's staff gave a pretty good overview. So, in lieu of giving you the whole history, I'd like to just start in with the current status of what the issues seem to be for the national environmental groups and what we might expect in this reauthorization. First of all, I'd like to pick up on what Rod said about the expiration of the exemption. As you know, in 1987, a variety of environmental and Alaskan fishing groups filed suit against the Secretary of Commerce to halt the granting of a permit to the Japanese High Seas Salmon Fishing Association. And the the reasoning behind the case was that the Japanese had requested a permit under the Marine Mammal Protection Act for authorization to take Dahl's porpoise in the course of their drift net fishing for salmon in the North Pacific. And the parties to the case charged that they would not only take Dahl's porpoise, they would also take northern fur seals and sea lions in the course of fishing. And the court found that the Marine Mammal Protection Act would not let the agency grant a permit to allow the taking of one species in fishing, that is, porpoises, when it also was known that other marine mammals would be taken for whom a permit could not be granted. The point of all that sort of legal gobbledygook there is that the principal mechanism of the MMPA that causes the conflict between fishing and marine mammals doing their own fishing is the moratorium on taking. And the only way that you can waive that moratorium or get rid of it is to prove that a marine mammal population or stock is at its optimum sustainable population, or OSP. And back in 1986, the agency could prove that the Dahl's porpoise were at OSP, but they could not do so for northern sea lions and northern fur seals. And in fact, the fur seals had been found to be depleted. So the upshot was that the Japanese could not get the permit, and the drift net fishery did not proceed that summer. The subsequent fallout was that in the following year, the general permit that had been granted to most of the West Coast fleet and a few East Coast fishing operations was to expire. And in order to reissue that permit, the agency had to go through the same kinds of findings for American vessels as it had gone through for the Japanese fleet. And it could not make findings that the marine mammals with whom the fisheries were interacting were at their optimum sustainable population. So, unable to meet the Kokachik standard and unable to grant the moratorium, we all found ourselves in a position where there was not enough information to make OSP findings, there was not enough information about interactions between marine mammals and commercial fisheries to know whether those impacts were negligible or significant, and therefore nobody could go fishing without exposing themselves to liability for take of marine mammals under the Act. In the spring of 1987, a variety of fishing industry groups and environmental groups began discussions to see what we could do to resolve the impasse. Those discussions led to a compromise that was designed to allow fishing to continue during a five-year period while the agency, the industry, gathered information about interactions between marine mammals and fishing operations, and to see what the nature of those interactions were and how frequent and so forth. Our compromise was translated by Congress into Section 114 of the MMPA, which is known as the interim exemption, or in the vernacular, the fish fix. That proposal, or that section of the Act, as Rod explained earlier, will expire at the end of September. And it's very critical that we address this issue under the MMPA as quickly as possible. It's my understanding that Beth Stewart will follow me on this panel to talk about the exemption program in some more detail. So I won't go into a lot right now, except to say that all of us had very high hopes for this information gathering program, and it hasn't been quite as thorough as we would have expected or hoped, but on the other hand, it's not been a waste of time. We do know more today about interactions between fishing operations mammals than we did in 1986 and 87. And at least from the perspective of the conservation community, the data from that program, which was gathered through a series of both observers and logbooks, participation by the industry, does provide a basis from which to begin our discussion. We have already begun talks again with the fishing industry. We've had one informal meeting and then one two-day meeting back here in D.C. To see just what the parameters are of our concerns, both about the interim exemption program over the last 4 years and about a proposal that the National Marine Fisheries Service has made to govern these interactions in the future. We've begun laying out what those concerns are, and we will begin on the 5th of April with a facilitator to start working through issue by issue. At least from the perspective of the conservation community, I'd like to say that we're very optimistic that we're going to find a lot of things to agree on. We're very pleased with the level of openness and willingness of all the parties to pitch in, roll up their sleeves, contribute what each of us knows about the variety of fisheries and the variety of critters, and try to figure out just where the real problems are and where they are not. That's going to be our principal focus for the coming months, because we are committed to having a new proposal before the Congress before the old one expires. Rod mentioned the possibility of an extension or a continuation of the exemption, and you should know that that's not looked upon favorably by the conservation community. There'd be great reluctance to just roll this current program over because we see a variety of elements in it that need some improvement. As far as other issues that might arise under the MMPA regime, again, we're trying to push our colleagues as much as Rod Moore was saying that they were pushing their colleagues to look at the commercial fishing exemption first and defer consideration of other issues for another year if necessary. Some of those other issues would include things like nuisance animals, scientific permits, types of animals from the wild for display, standards for care and maintenance of captive marine mammals, and possibly subsistence, although we have heard of no topics along that line, except for some groups in California who are working to clarify the language on what is customary and traditional under the Catalnikoff decision. That's the sea otter case. Of that sort of grab bag of possibilities, the ones that might be of interest to you with regard to nuisance animals, for example, the issue there is competition between marine mammals and commercially valuable fish, basically predation of gear or of catch and destruction of fishing gear. There's also, of course, the problem with the sea lions and the steelhead, the recreationally valued steelhead in Puget Sound. The display issues are mainly being pushed by the display industry, the folks who run aquariums and marine parks, and my organization, we pretty much don't have a dog or a dolphin in that fight, as it were. And finally, it's possible that issues of treaty rights to use of marine mammals or co-management of marine mammals between tribes, states, and the federal government might be raised as issues. Right now, we're just in a watch-and-see mode on those topics. We're concentrating most of our energy on working with the fishing industry to come up with a proposal on fishing interactions. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions about where the Center for Marine Conservation is coming from, either on MMPA or SCMA, some of the other things we were discussing today. or further questions about the negotiations.
Any questions of Suzanne? Thank you, Suzanne.
Thank you very much for inviting us.
Well, we'd like to go to Larry McCulloch at St. Paul. Are you there, Larry?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much. My name is Larry McCulloch, and I'm the Vice Chair of the Indigenous People's Council on Marine Mammals. The Indigenous Council is composed of representatives from all Indigenous user groups from the Arctic to Southeast Alaska. It's organized for the purpose of coordination of activities and actions and exchange of information between Indigenous marine mammal user groups. And the Indigenous Council takes action by consensus, and the Alaska Federation of Natives defers to the Council on all marine mammal issues. The number one priority of the Indigenous People's Council with regard to the MMPA is to maintain the existing Native exemption pursuant to Section 101B of the Act, which allows Alaska Natives to take marine mammals for subsistence purposes and production of handicrafts. At this point in time, the user groups do not intend to propose any amendments to the MMPA unless other interest groups propose amendments that are adverse to Native interests if such proposals receive serious consideration by the committees in Congress, or unless our proposals are acceptable to all other interest groups. And to this extent, the state position paper, which I believe the committee has, is incorrect. We are on record as unanimously opposing amendments apparently being proposed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And the primary reason for this opposition is that the service did not engage in a process which ensured meaningful and broad Alaska Native input into the proposals, and these proposals were developed from the past federal administration. We also oppose any amendments which seek to further regulate Native subsistence use of marine mammals beyond what already exists, or which seeks to diminish the priority status of subsistence users more than what already exists. The Indigenous People's Council supports increased cooperative, multidisciplinary, multinational scientific research and management, increased funding for research and management, and meaningful involvement of Indigenous peoples in research and management. We are concerned about the alarming declines of many species in the Bering Sea and North Pacific, including the Stellar sea lions, which are down 80 to 85% from Kenai to the Commodorsky, the northern fur seals, which are down 60% since their historic peaks, harbor seals, which have declined at similar levels or higher than the sea lions, MERS and kittiwakes. 90% of the world's population of red-legged kittiwakes resides in the Pribilof Islands, and their declines have gone down anywhere from 56 to 80%. Cormorants, puffins, eiders in the eastern Bering Sea down 56 to 80%. And of course, the pollock declines, as evidenced by what has occurred by the what has been determined by the joint resolution between Bush and Yeltsin, closing off the donut hole to pollock fishing from their countrymen, and also the closure of the Boguslav pollock nursing zone, codfish and halibut. Now, we believe that these declines of these species are significant and interconnected, and therefore requires change in the single species oriented research management regime if we're to determine what corrective management is required. If a principal reason for the decline is human caused, these declines may continue until several species are brought to the brink of extinction, which in turn will cause hardship amongst Native subsistence user groups and economic hardship from Alaska to the North Pacific in many areas of human activity. With regard to marine mammal fishery interactions, we only have one observation at this time that we'd like to bring the subcommittee's attention to, only to highlight a concern which we believe everyone should pay attention to, or And the assumption is that this is a conservative approach which will ensure a large and stable fish biomass. But such a system does not input food budgets for fish-consuming competitors. Instead, other competitors are managed on a basis of optimum sustainable population, or OSP. OSP levels are not easily determinable. The National Marine Fisheries Service, for example, utilized first year population levels in the 1950s as the benchmark for determining in 1988 that first years are depleted because they're supposedly at least 50% below OSP at 1950s number. Now, OSP is supposed to take into account the carrying capacity of the ecosystem, and if this principle is properly applied, the first year population today is theoretically at levels the carrying capacity can support. Thus, the first eels are at 100% of OSP, even while their population is depleted. Now, given this, the OSP standard can be used objectively, and thus it's not adequate for management of marine mammals. The point is that OSP standards require that marine mammals go to levels which threaten their viability before any corrective actions are taken. And the fishery management system does not take into account the food budgets of marine mammals. Such a system will always force fishery management and fishing industry to react to crisis and for marine mammal populations to go to crisis levels. Well, thank you for this opportunity to comment, and I'd be glad to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. McCouriot. Any questions of Larry? Now we'll go to Noam. Charlie Johnson, are you on the line?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Okay, I'm the acting executive director of the Eskimo Walrus Commission, and I wanted to just reinforce the position that Larry McCurlyoff has stated. The Eskimo Walrus Commission has also stated that their number one priority, of course, is the maintenance of the native exemption and the reauthorization of the Act. And we have also taken the position that we will not offer amendments, although there are some amendments that we would like to see. We will not offer those amendments unless there are other amendments that are contrary to our well-being, and or if these amendments are acceptable to all of the other parties that are involved. Our primary focus is on walrus. We're also involved with other species that are used by our people up in the Seward Peninsula, all the way from the Bristol Bay area to the Arctic slope. So we're very cognizant of the fact that some of the species that are being used are declining. And the approach that Larry has stated by the Indigenous Peoples Council on Marine Mammals, which we are a part of, is the one that we are supporting as far as looking at the need for more multiple disciplinary cooperation in addressing these problems. So I am just stating that our support for the approach that Larry McCurlyoff has voiced. And if there's any questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
Thank you, Charlie. I'll go on to Beth Stewart, Aleutians Eastboro.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Beth Stewart, and I am Director of the Natural Resources Department for the Aleutians Eastboro. In 1988, when the fisheries exemption was granted, was the first time that people in the Aleutians Eastboro realized what kind of problems were going on with Stellar Sea Lions. People along both the Bering Sea and Gulf Coasts of the Aleutians Eastboro are salmon fishermen, groundfish fishermen, used to be on the Gulf side crab fishermen. We no longer have crab on the Gulf side to harvest. And they also are subsistence users of all the natural resources in that area. The severe decline of Steller sea lions occurs primarily around Kodiak and the Aleutians East Borough communities of Sandpoint, King Cove, False Pass, and Nelson Lagoon, and then further on out in the western Aleutians. The people in this region carried marine mammal observers on their vessels for a year, and then they were declassified from that category into a lower category because the observations indicated that fisheries interactions with Steller sea lions were not part of the problem. However, that did not change local concerns about Steller sea lions. We have been working since 1988 with environmental groups and within our region and with people in Kodiak to try and develop a better scientific information base for Steller sea lions and other marine mammals. We know that the state has made efforts and that National Marine Fisheries Service have made efforts to gather that data. We're somewhat concerned that there have been some funding problems. NIMS has not, for instance, transferred all of the money they probably should have to the state to gather information about Stellars. Once an animal reaches the status that the Steller sea lion has reached, the government's required to take conservation measures, even if they don't know that those conservation measures are going to have a positive impact on the species of concern. In our region, we have several rookeries with 3 mile circles around them. Those are no transit zones. You can't even go around those islands unless you're in danger of sinking. We have 20 mile no trawl zones further along the western part of the Aleutians. That's displaced a large number of vessels that used to fish in that area, and so far have no indication that those measures have actually done anything to improve or stabilize the population. People of the Aleutians East Borough realize that their livelihood depends on a rich and diverse marine environment. They're in support of measures that will improve the status of stocks in that area. We're very concerned now about harbor seal declines. So are the people in Kodiak. I guess one of the things that many commercial fishermen in the state, many fishermen of all types in the state, don't understand is that even though the problem rookeries are in the Kodiak and western Aleutians, eastern Aleutians area, that's viewed as a single population. The northern sea lion is viewed as a single population. So although in southeastern you have healthy numbers of sea lions, and you may appear to have healthy numbers of sea lions in Prince William Sound, all those fisheries will be treated the same way because as a total, that population is in trouble. They're highly migratory. They may return to the same rookeries annually, but during the course of the rest of the year, they cover the Bering Sea and the Gulf, apparently somewhat at random. We support increased research and to that end have joined a group of other commercial fishing interests and the PSPA, Pacific Seafood Process Association, in funding research through the University of British Columbia. Aleutians East Borough has contributed $5,000 this year to that project and will be contributing additional money over the years. We have been actively involved, as Suzanne Uticello mentioned, in meetings with Center for Marine Conservation and other conservation organizations. We've attended meetings in DC this year and in New Orleans, and we'll continue to do that. We're part of the working group that's been put together, and we'll be working through a facilitator to identify points of consensus between ourselves and the conservation groups involved, and then identifying those areas where we don't have consensus so that we can work on those specific areas. It's our belief that the stronger the package that we present to Congress as a group, the more likelihood of having speedy passage. And as you've heard several times today, September 30th is the drop-dead date for the fisheries exemption that allows people to continue to earn a living from both the Bering Sea and the Gulf of Alaska. So we are engaged in those efforts. We'll continue to be engaged in those efforts. And we urge the legislature to take a close look at those funding issues that the Department of Fish and Game requires to better understand population problems in this area. I think we agree to some extent, although we have not signed on to the positions mentioned by Larry McCulloch and Charlie Johnson, that biodiversity, that understanding ecosystem interactions is going to be important. There's a large level of frustration with not finding out that there's a problem until the problem is so bad that you're threatened with not fishing. We have marbled murrelets in the region. Marbled murrelets in the Pacific Northwest are probably going on the threatened species list, if not the endangered species list. They're not, as far as we know, migratory, but there's this level of fear now every time you hear about some additional animal, you have to think about what that's going to do to fishing in your area. We have Stellar eiders and spectacled eiders in the region, and I'm sorry, I always forget which one is getting listed and which one isn't. Both are probably equally eligible for listing and are present at the times people are fishing. So we support strong ADF and G budgets. We think that the more information we have about population levels and about interactions between those populations, the more likelihood there'll be that we can have a healthy fishing economy in the region. Thank you.
Thank you, Beth. Any questions of Beth Stewart? At this time, we've gone to the Endangered Species Act. And do we have Eric Jorgensen to testify of the Sierra Club?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Eric Jorgensen. I'm the managing attorney for the Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund here in Juneau. And I've been asked to say a few general words about the Endangered Species Act as, by way of introduction this morning. And I know things are running a little late, so I'll try to keep my remarks brief and give you a chance to ask me any questions if you have them. The Endangered Species Act is one of the nation's earliest and most effective environmental laws, and one that has had broadest support in Congress and with the American people for a long time. The Act is a relatively simple law that has been somewhat improved over the years from its original enactment in 1973. The process of the Endangered Species Act begins with a listing of a species as either threatened or endangered by the Fish and Wildlife Service or the National Marine Fisheries Service. That listing triggers a variety of protections under the Act. The first is an obligation by the agencies to look to see whether there are critical habitats for listed species that need to be protected to ensure their survival and so that they can recover and be removed from the endangered species lists. The second protection that arises once a species is listed under the Act is an obligation for federal agencies to consult with the Fish and Wildlife Service before it takes actions that may affect a listed species. And the purpose of that is for the Fish and Wildlife Service to prepare a biological opinion, determine whether the proposed action is going to jeopardize the continued existence of the species, and then make recommendations as need be to modify the action if necessary, or make recommendations so that the federal action can go forward without affecting adversely the listed species and promoting its recovery instead. The third basic protection provided by the Act is the prohibition against taking individual listed members of a species. The prohibition against taking applies not just to federal actions, but state and private activities in some circumstances. The Act in this regard provides a fair amount of flexibility. The Act doesn't impose a blanket prohibition in all circumstances. It allows for incidental takes under certain conditions when there's an activity that leads to incidental taking of species. Permits can be issued and authorizations can be granted for small level takes that don't affect the survival of the species. The Fish and Wildlife Service has discretion for threatened species to promulgate special rules that allow for activities to proceed that have an impact on the species as long as it doesn't affect their survival. And there are other opportunities for flexibility within the system that relate to this taking prohibition. And finally, the Act imposes an obligation on federal agencies to develop a recovery plan once a species is listed, to identify the ways in which federal and state government and private parties can take actions to help a species recover and get it off the endangered or threatened species list. And ultimately, that's the goal of the Endangered Species Act, is to try to identify ways in which to change the way activities are being done, or identify problems that people aren't aware of, so that we solve problems and remove species from the list so that we can continue with activities and at the same time protect the ecosystems and species that depend on them. I just want to say a few general words about the Act from my perspective, or and the perspective, I think, of the environmental community in general. And I think the main messages are, from my perspective, that the Act is working today, and that it does so most of the time, the large majority of the time, with very few conflicts with development and economic projects. The Act has succeeded in protecting species and ecosystems. There's a long list of species, beginning with ones that everybody knows about, the bald eagle and the alligator and whooping crane and brown pelican, and the list it goes on and on, of species that were listed in the 70s and where there were problems identified, actions that could be taken to reverse the decline, and today those species are on the road to recovery. In some cases have been delisted by the Fish and Wildlife Service. There are conflicts between the Endangered Species Act and development projects, but those are extraordinarily rare for the most part. There are over 700 species on the endangered species list. There are thousands of federal projects every year that go through the consultation process with the Fish and Wildlife Service. And as a general rule, less than 1 in 1,000 federal projects that are reviewed by the Fish and Wildlife Service that relate to endangered species can't be modified in a way that they can proceed consistent with the Act. One commonly quoted statement from somebody from the Nature Conservancy is that a developer has a greater chance of an airplane crashing into his project than having the Endangered Species Act stop it. So there are, of course, conflicts, and some of them are highly publicized. The spotted owl in the Pacific Northwest, for example, is one that everybody's familiar with. Those sorts of problems develop primarily when we wait too long, when we don't pay attention to the warning signs about species decline and ecosystem dysfunction, and we wait until the very last minute, and then of course there are problems, and then there are lots of conflicts between protection and development. And I think that that brings me to sort of my thinking about the Endangered Species Act in Alaska. We haven't really seen much impact of the Endangered Species Act yet in Alaska. There are a few species listed, and it hasn't caused the sort of significant impact that we've seen in other places yet on Alaska's major industries. But we're beginning to see the effect of the Stellar Sea Lions. We've heard talk today from Larry Mikulyov and others about the substantial concern in the Bering Sea region and other places about declines in marine populations of mammals and birds and fish. We know that the Fish and Wildlife Service is about to list the spectacle eider as a threatened species, there are concerns about species that reside in the coastal rainforest ecosystem. The murrelet has been mentioned this morning, the goshawk, and a variety of other species that depend on the coastal rainforest ecosystem in Alaska for their habitat. I think that we're at a position here in Alaska where we have a chance to do it right. This morning, John Sisk from SEAC referred to Secretary Babbitt's reference to train wrecks and how he wants to try to work the Endangered Species Act so we avoid the train wrecks, where we wait to the last minute and then there's nothing to be done. And I think here in Alaska, we're still in a position where, in a lot of cases, we don't have to wait to the last minute. We still have opportunities to look at the way we're managing resources. The speakers that follow me, I'm sure, will be talking about some of the specific things where we're seeing some impact today, from salmon, particularly. We're seeing impacts from activities that take place outside Alaska. And I think our main advantage and our main opportunity here is to act now and not wait for the train wrecks. So I'll stop there if anybody has any questions.
Thank you, Eric. Any questions for Mr. Jorgensen? Thanks again. Ron Somerville?
Thank you again, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ron Somerville, Special Assistant Commissioner, Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I think Eric has done a pretty good job of outlining at least some parts of the act that, and probably purposes of which most of us would agree with why it was initially passed. I would like to point out, though, that this is one act which has train wreck built into it, partly just because a lot of the recent interpretations by the courts, litigation efforts, most recently Greenpeace attempting to shut down a good portion of the pollock fisheries off the coast because of the decline in stellar sea lions. And I'd like to address those just briefly, if I may. From the standpoint, when we talk about the overview, the Endangered Species Act, I think we look at it here, involves more than just salmon. I think we're starting to see the emphasis of the environmental community towards Endangered Species Act as a major law for the purposes of protecting ecosystems. And not that that's bad, but the problem is the Endangered Species Act was distinctly designed to protect species and isn't really properly structured to protect ecosystems, per se. I've had some experience with the Act. I think that you've got to kind of look back at it through the years and see where, in fact, it works and where it doesn't. And it's where it doesn't work that forces us to look at a number of amendments or at least some modifications which we feel should be made to the Act. I'm personally a member of an ad hoc committee of the Western Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies, as well as the International Association, a similar ad hoc committee designed to try to craft certain types of amendments and proposals for the Act, which could go forward. This also led to a recent adoption of some modifications proposed by the Western Governors Conference. In almost all cases in the discussions with the other states, what you see is that people say, gee, the Act is properly structured here if the agencies would properly administer it. And that is, to give you an example, the Endangered Species Act has two parts to it, and one is endangered and one is threatened. As Eric pointed out, there is a significant latitude for the Secretary of Commerce or Interior to allow the taking of threatened species. However, in almost every case the species has been listed as threatened, the secretaries have chosen, which is their discretion, to not allow a taking. What that does is create, in cases like for grizzly bears in Montana, not allowing taking of bears that are listed as threatened, is you have a significant conflict between the Cattlemen's Association, if you will, and the recovery of grizzly bears in that area. So without any taking provisions, lawfully what you have is people going out and illegally shooting bears indiscriminately because this thing is not crafted in such a fashion as to take into consideration the problems they have as this species moves back towards recovery. I can list you a number of cases where, in fact, the National Marine Fisheries Service, or Interior in particular, have chosen to take the high road at the expense of the recovery programs. To me, that's counterproductive. All the Western states in particular have testified that this sort of attitude by the agencies is counterproductive, in fact, to the very purpose of the Act, and that is recovery of species that are listed. Another problem is, once a species gets on the list, it's almost impossible to get it off. Despite what Eric says, the delisting process has bogged down to practically ground zero. As an example, when I was back in Washington last time, we were working and attempting to get the delisting of three different populations of kangaroos in Australia. And although the Fish and Wildlife Service had addressed the status of those populations three different times and recommended their own biological staff they be delisted, that the populations were exceeding 3 million animals, the environmental community opposed it consistently because they wanted to make sure they weren't imported or there were strict regulations on import into the United States. Here, the law was not being used for recovery purposes. It was being used for the purposes of restricting international trade. I also want to emphasize that the Endangered Species Act is intricately tied to what they call the Convention, International Trade of Endangered Species of Flora and Fauna. This is a treaty signed by the United States of, along with 115 other nations. And the purpose of this is, in fact, to restrict the international trade of species that are listed or species that are considered in poor shape throughout. We use the Endangered Species Act as a factor to give us some targets as to the areas in the United States that we feel should have some international trade restrictions. I can assure you, and Chuck will probably deal with this when he talks about the Pacific Salmon Commission, but my recent trips to Washington, it's almost positive that there will be a request to list the Chinook salmon from the Snake River on the CITES convention, either on Appendix 1 or Appendix 2. In short, what that may mean is that there will be strict international trade restrictions on Chinook salmon from the Columbia River system. The problem is that when they do this, there's also a look-alike provision, which means that if you have a restriction on Chinook from the Columbia River, there will probably be a request that the look-alike provisions be implemented, which means any Chinook salmon throughout the Pacific Northwest in particular will probably be restricting somewhat in international trade. I agree that's a worst-case scenario, but I'm trying to explain to you the impact, potential impacts, if you will, of the Endangered Species Act and its intertie to the CITES. I also want to emphasize here that, that which I tell the staff, which is really extremely important, is the intricacies, the interties with the Marine Mammal Protection Act. It's already been mentioned by Suzanne and others that we have a critical drop-dead date of September 30th. We also have interrelations of the two acts because the Marine Mammal Protection Act references the Endangered Species Act and provisions and vice versa. I'm not going to go with that in detail, but I'm saying we look at one, it's very important that we look at the other because they're intricately tied together. I also want to emphasize in terms of the department in that the commissioner has continued to emphasize the need for, as best we can, expanded research into areas involving endangered species like stellar sea lions, potentially harbor seal listings. I tell the commercial fisheries friends that they better support the wildlife conservation budget because they're the only division in the department right now that's doing any research on stellar sea lions and harbor seals, and the information which has been pointed out we desperately need in protecting our interest is totally dependent upon we get from that particular division. So it's starting to show the interties in the department between the various divisions that we have in this research effort. Chuck is going to cover the Pacific Salmon Commission and Chinook. I just want to emphasize that the standards for listing, obviously Chinook has qualified. We've seen that stellar sea lion has qualified even though the numbers are extremely high. Harbor seals may qualify. It's been emphasized by others that they may be, when they're listing, they may be throughout the entire population range. It may not be limited to just a small portion of the population. So if harbor seals are listed, in essence, they could be listed throughout their entire range. The problem is that you have all the restrictions of the Endangered Species Act. This is a problem, and it's one that we feel should be addressed somehow in the amendment process. The other one is the definition of species in per se. We really feel it's extremely important to look at whether or not specific stocks should be listed, and the National Marine Fisheries Service has proposed some alternatives in this area. Whether or not a stock, a specific spring stock of Snake River, in fact, is biologically distinct enough that it should be listed as a endangered or threatened species. That doesn't mean you shouldn't give it attention, but whether or not it deserves the attention of the legal attention of the Endangered Species Act. We feel the role of the state should be enhanced and has been ignored somewhat in the Endangered Species Act, and I've already mentioned that to some extent. The major role we feel is in the listing and delisting process, as well as the cooperative work is provided for Section 6 in the Endangered Species Act, and that is for cooperative funding with the states to help in the recovery program. I will say that we have staff in Alaska, at least, have been involved in recovery programs. Lloyd Lowry has been on the Stellar Sea Lion recovery team, and I think we've had a significant input into that. The take provisions you've already covered to some extent. There are a lot of complications of the take provisions, not just the incidental take as it relates to marine mammal or to our commercial fisheries. The last one I wanted to mention was Secretary Babbitt has mentioned the possibility of trying to do some group listings. We're concerned about that. It kind of depends on what he means by that. I think some of you probably seen in the Northwest, the American Fisheries Society has indicated that probably 200 some various stocks of salmon could qualify for listing on the Endangered Species Act as either threatened or endangered. If the Secretary were to take it upon himself to list all of those in a group listing, obviously we'd be scampering around trying to figure out how we were going to respond, even though some of them may in fact deserve some sort of listings. It's also important, I think, because the standards of the Endangered Species Act are in some cases very loose. You could take populations like we look around southeastern, for instance, and you can look at some very small populations of salmon in particular, or steelhead and others, that they are never at their best OSP, as some people refer in the Marine Mammal Protection Act, very large. So modifications, which may be in the structure and size of those populations due to environmental conditions or whatever, may drive those species below what may trigger an endangered species listing, where in fact it's normal population variations. We've expressed that concern on marine mammals and others as well. In many cases, quite frankly, we don't have the information necessary to defend a listing proposal. Anybody can petition for listing under Endangered Species Act, and then the impetus and the burden of proof is back on us to determine whether or not they deserve listing. I only mention that because the whole research efforts of the state trying to target these high-profile species, ones that try to indicate in advance those that may be targeted for listing, is really a major problem that we have. Mr. Chairman, I'll stop at that. I realize I covered a lot of ground, but I know you're behind on schedule, and I'll take any questions you have.
Any questions for Mr. Summerall? Representative Davidson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Special Commissioner, you're going to go back representing the state of Alaska and Washington on many of these important issues. And yet, I realize you have a very vast background as far as a biologist and one who has a sincere concern for wildlife and endangered species. But you've left me kind of cold here because I don't really understand, you know, whether you think that the Act, the ESA, you said it involves more than species protection, yet it seemed that you passed lightly over the danger of ecosystem problems. And does that mean to say that you're going to go back with the attitude or with the push that, hey, there is not a problem in Alaska for stellar sea lions, or we should not, in fact, be a part of the effort to ensure that problems on the Snake River are not interrelated? I guess I'm a little confused as to the direction and the thrust of what you will be taking back to Washington as an argument to the new administration.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Davidson, I didn't mean to imply that the state is out, or we're going to propose, or we would even advocate to any citizen group that we're going to propose doing away with the Endangered Species Act. I think what we're seeing is it's evolving at a fairly rapid rate at this point, and I think the consensus of the people that I've worked with on the Endangered Species Act is poorly equipped, in fact, to deal with a lot of the ecosystems that may need some modifications, if that's the intent. Some of the arguments are maybe that the biodiversity issue should be implemented through some sort of legislation to deal with the ecosystems, where in fact the Endangered Species Act, quite frankly, is directed towards a listing of a species and then initiating some recovery program. Secretary Babbitt has indicated maybe we need some sort of process to identify species before they reach this stage, and I think almost everybody would agree with that. We have some concerns as to how that might be incorporated, obviously, if we have a pre-threatened listing, which ends up being what the threatened listing was supposed to have been in the first place, then we're probably just, you know, overemphasizing something that's already in place. But in answer specifically to the ecosystem issues raised, of course we have problems in Alaska. A lot of it has to do with management problems. A lot of them has to do, as I said, with lack of information, problems that are held over from the high seas fisheries problems in the past, things that happened before statehood, for that matter. So yes, we have problems in the state, and to ignore them would be foolish. We're not going to go back, though, on this issue or any of them, in my opinion, and say that we're going to try to gut those. We're going to try to make them fit, if you will, and include Alaska's needs in that process. I think Suzanne pointed that out. We don't want to see the commercial fisheries shut down because we take one Chinook salmon out of 25,000 that may be destined for the Columbia River system. That's not fair. That our economy must be shut down because the other states haven't been able to deal with their ecosystem problems. So, you know, it's those sort of trade-offs that I'm sure you'll get into discussion with Chuck on, but we do feel the Endangered Species Act can meet its objectives, can work towards the improvement of some of the environmental concerns, at least if it's linked with things that are going on in the biodiversity area and the ecosystem management areas. But I'm just saying that recent court rulings, litigation and others are creating some cause for concern that it's going to the extreme. If in fact Greenpeace had won their stellar sea lion case, for instance, it wouldn't help the stellar sea lion in all likelihood, but would have shut down the ground fishery, and I don't think that was in the best interest of Alaska nor the stellar sea lion. So I'm just emphasizing the problem.
How are you going to propose to deal with the insufficient information as far as listing proposals are concerned?
Mr. Chairman,
for the sake of time, I think we'll reserve our questions for another forum and time. Thank you, Mr. Summer.
Thank you.
The Cape Troll, would you come forward, please?
Thank you. For the record, my name is Cape Troll. I serve as Executive Director of Southeast Alaska Salmon. But I'm here more to talk to you in the capacity of having recently attended a National Fisheries Institute conference back in D.C., which brought together commercial fishing groups from across the country to talk about Magnuson marine mammals and the endangered species. Because of the interactions we're having right now in Southeast on the endangered species, I focused my time and energy back there on the Endangered Species Act and am now part of a national committee of fishing organizations working on this. And I'd like to just point out that this act indeed has been effective, as Eric Jorgensen has outlined to you, but at the same time, it's also been, you know, a very handy tool that's been abused. And it's a type of legislation or act that sometimes you don't know where it's going to go. The ricochet effect of this legislation is quite disconcerting, and I think you'll hear a little bit about that and talk about Pacific Salmon Treaty next. The things that we've sort of outlined back as a, it was really an informal discussion, but looking at, you know, what were some of the major problems. We think the act needs to be fixed. It doesn't need to be canned or repealed, and we would like to be able to find some opportunities to work with the moderate environmental groups like we have been on the Marine Mammal Protection Act to try and find some consensus between balancing out the needs of the ecosystem and the species and the economy. That's the primary focus of our discussion that we had back in this national conference. Some of the things we outlined were we need to look at the definition of species. Right now, the act is being applied to very isolated populations. I don't think that was ever intended when Congress first passed the act. So we'd like to see that part revisited, the definition of species or subspecies. There were some groups, commercial fishing groups, that felt that things have gotten so out of whack, they looked at this as the Genetic Materials Protection Act. You know, so we'd like to get it directed back toward species and not these little isolated populations to where you have to go through a 45 steps to differentiate. Is this different than what we see here across the river? I mean, it's gotten so detailed. The other effort is we'd like to see the primary responsibility for the corrective actions to be directed to the primary threat to the species. Right now, there isn't any of those such concepts built into the act. You need a better determination of the listing criteria. Ron touched on that, and I think that's something the environmental community also agrees with, is the scientific basis for listing is rather loose right now, and we need defined criteria and as well as the burden of proof. In looking at the economics, we discussed that at great length and felt that the question of listing needs to be based solely on the biological sciences, that that's not the appropriate place where economics needs to enter in, but rather economics enters into the corrective decisions and the critical habitat and the management plan and those sorts of things that get brought forward. That if you try and have economics be part of the listing process, it was our sense that we'll get nowhere on the reauthorization of the Endangered Species Act, just given the current political climate. I'd like to just sort of, I'll be real brief because I know we're running late, but I see an opportunity here within the new administration and within the Congress, because to try and meld the jobs and the protection of the environment together. And the Endangered Species Act is going to be one of those bellwether legislation. It's going to be a very challenging task for the administration, because on one hand, the Clinton got elected for jobs. On the other hand, he has a very strong environmental advocate in Vice President Gore. How those two emphases get melded together, I think we're going to get a first glimpse of that and what's happening at the Forest Summit here, April 2nd. And I'm encouraged by what I see. Yesterday's Juneau Empire, there was a story here about Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt looking at an experiment in California, to where they've made some trade-offs between the economic needs as well as the requirements of the Endangered Species Act. You know, they're looking at this modification here on one species of bird to maybe be a trailblazing effort on how these issues and concerns are going to begin to get melded. And I personally feel that the commercial fishing industry presents a unique opportunity to try and show some leadership on the reauthorization and how we might be able to do a better job in melding these two primary interests of the Clinton administration as well as of Congress. Secretary Babbitt also talks about establishing a national commission. He doesn't want to have the interagency squabbles. I think those are all things we can work with. He also mentions an ecosystem management approach. As far as Alaska is concerned, I'm not particularly frightened by that approach. I think our ecosystem integrity up here is something that we can defend. Rick Lauber pointed out how we're able to defend our actions on the council compared to other regions of the state. I think the same thing would apply if we started taking an ecosystem approach toward the Endangered Species Act. So I just would like to kind of close on a somewhat of an encouraging note in that, yeah, this is a very troublesome act, but I think if we get in a productive manner with the new administration, with the new Congress, and we capture some of these ideas that are being floated out right now, and we try and take a proactive role in how to mold these concepts that would suit Alaska, I think we'll be better off, and I think there's a unique opportunity for Alaska to really provide some leadership on this. Thank you.
Thank you, Kate Curl. I will go on to the Pacific Salmon Treaty. All on Chuck Meacham, trying to be as brief as possible. Still give us a lot of information.
My specialty, Mr. Chairman.
Will be.
Thank you. I do appreciate the invitation to appear before you today. There was a handout provided earlier that included some of the key issues, including some correspondence from Commissioner Rozier to the National Marine Fisheries Service, primarily related to ESA aspects of the problem. I'll just speak briefly about ESA and then speak about the Pacific Salmon Treaty. The two, in fact, are very separate matters. With regard to the Endangered Species Act, Snake River Fall Chinook were listed as threatened under ESA the summer of 1992. We are required in our Alaska fisheries to obtain an incidental take permit in order to have a legal fishery. We're in the process of doing that. The Southeast Alaska fishery take is very small of those listed fish, The fractional abundance within our fishery in southeast Alaska is 0.0002. That's the fractional abundance of these listed Snake River Chinook in our fishery down here. There are two ways to obtain this incidental take permit. One is through Section 7 of the ESA. The other is through Section 10. Section 7 is appropriate where you have a federal connection, a federal government activity. Section 10 is where you do not. The Section 7 is relatively straightforward. There's a mandatory approximately 135 days that the federal government can take in processing the information. Section 10 approach, on the other hand, can require years and includes public hearings and a very, very complicated process. The most recent information we have as to the outcome of any ESA actions were presented at the Pacific Council meeting here a couple of weeks ago. That was in San Francisco. Pacific Council manages the fisheries off the states of Washington, Oregon, California. It's parallel to the North Pacific Council we have here in Alaska. At that meeting, they chose to, for the purposes of modeling the effects of different fisheries on their stocks, they chose to plug into that model a reduced number for the Alaska Chinook. They reduced our traditional take by about 25,000 fish. This was suggested by a motion of the National Marine Fisheries Service. They indicated without prejudice, but nevertheless, it certainly gives an idea of where they were coming from at that point in time. What are we doing? At this point, we're working as best we're able with the National Marine Fisheries Service on the biological assessment. That's the document that puts together the effects of the fishery on the listed species. And frankly, that's one of the irritating aspects of this meeting in San Francisco, that they would choose to come out with a recommendation showing a reduction in our Alaska fisheries prior to the time that we even had our biological assessment put together and sent to them. Very disappointing. But we will continue to work with them. We're working as well with the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council. We're working through the Pacific Salmon Treaty process. Those latter two will be our federal connection in getting an exemption. We are as well monitoring court cases. We sent John Gisberg with the Attorney General's office, who's on assignment to Fish and Game, down to a meeting in Portland on the 22nd of March. And we'll continue to work with the affected user groups here in Alaska. Those include the Alaska Trollers Association, and Dale Kelly is here, Southeast Alaska Seiners Association, Kate Troll just spoke with you, United Southeast Alaska Gillnetters, Southeast Fishermen Coalition, all have members and representatives that we work with in trying to get through the process. We also have a very strong northern panel within the Pacific Salmon Treaty process, who's of great assistance to us. With that, I'll move on specifically to the Pacific Salmon Treaty. As you probably are aware, the Pacific Salmon Treaty is a framework treaty. It was signed in 1985. The different fisheries are managed under chapter or annex provisions associated with this framework treaty. These annexes are periodically negotiated. This year, we've had two 10-day negotiation sessions during the last few months, followed by a number of teleconferences, most recently, the most recent of which took place yesterday morning. Our current plan is to try and arrange a meeting with the Canadians to bilaterally reach agreement this year. That suggestion to them has been put forward for mid-April. The letter just went out the other day, so there's no response to that yet. But we've suggested an agenda and meeting dates, and we'll do our best to work with them to achieve an agreement. the agenda for the meeting as we proposed it is to take care of our immediate 1993 needs. Those, the biggest of which probably relates to Chinook, the coastwide Chinook problem. We also have on the agenda transboundary rivers in Alaska. We have Fraser Annex, west coast of Vancouver Island, Chinook and Coho issues that need to be addressed. There's also a southern Chum Annex that would be rolled over. A side element is the northern boundary. As relates to the northern boundary area, that includes Noyes Island fishery, Tree Point Gillnet fishery. We're not proposing any changes to those. We do have some elements that were put together at our last negotiation session very successfully between the Alaska Northern Panel and the Canadian Northern Panel, and we would like to have those ratified by the Commission as a whole when we get together. This represents some win-win situations within the Portland Canal area in particular. What are we doing here? I will be going next week to Washington, D.C. on Pacific Salmon Commission matters. We have, again, scheduled, at least within the U.S. section, get together with the Canadians. We hope we're successful on that. We do have a full northern panel working as best we're able to put together our positions and take care of our Alaska fisheries through the Pacific Salmon Treaty process. And I emphasize through the process because we are trying to make it work. It appears to me that there are others who are not as interested in seeing this process work. We're still doing our best. It's been a troublesome process, but we'd like to make it work to take care of our fisheries here. One last issue with regard to Pacific Salmon Treaty. There's an element of the Pacific Salmon Treaty that calls for developing a Yukon River Salmon Treaty. This last Wednesday, Thursday, we had a meeting of the United States advisors, who are all Alaskans, in Anchorage. It was not a meeting with the Canadians, but we did have our chief negotiator from Washington, D.C. there, and another advisor from Washington, D.C. Very good meeting, but the folks involved with the development of the Yukon Treaty are growing much more cautious about putting together this treaty, as they certainly should. I think the difficulties we've seen down in Southeast just make us that much more cautious and careful in developing this, so that we are in fact able to protect not only the Yukon River fish, but our access to those fish and our ability as a state to manage those fisheries. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Chuck. Thank you, Mr. Meacham. Any questions of Mr. Meacham? Well, thank you again. Dale Kelly, would you want to give a brief presentation again on this one?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I introduced myself before, I'm Dale Kelly. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Trawlers Association, and until this January, I was a member of the Northern Panel of the Pacific Salmon Commission. I was asked to come here today to give you, I guess, pretty much the troll perspective on where we're at in treaty, where we're heading, and some of our concerns. I think the first thing that is often a little misunderstood about the treaty between the U.S. and Canada is that it's not really always, the issues don't always center on Canadian concerns and the U.S. concerns. It's very much a tripartite arrangement, being Alaska, the Lower 48, and Canada. And many times our problems come more from the U.S. delegation to the south, much more than the Canadians. The North Central Canadians, as Chuck was pointing out, have been very good about sitting down and trying to work out our issues. We're very similar in a lot of respects. But the fact of the matter is that most of the fish that we fish on here in Southeast come from either Canada or the Lower 48, and there's a lot of territorial posturing that surrounds the Columbia River. We are, at this point in time, I guess the good thing that we could say about the treaty is that it has been very successful with respect to rebuilding Chinook stocks. And many of the stocks that are in our fishery are in quite good shape. And the double edge to that sword has been, we have had almost a doubling of abundance since the pre-treaty base period. And our fishermen, for the large part, have been unable to participate in their gains. We have regularly, well, probably the best example is the fact that our general summer season used to be 169 days long, and last year we fished 4.5 days for a general Chinook season in the Choll fishery. The disruption that the abundance has caused has been very severe. We don't have many new tricks in the Choll fishery. It's a 100-year-old fishery. It's fishermen aren't doing anything necessarily different. There's just a lot of fish out there, and we're catching them very fast, and that is causing other political problems for our fishery, which we are seeing played in other forums by the Lower 48 delegation. We suspect that there will be some problems at the North Pacific Council meeting coming up in April that will divert some of the attention away from the importance of getting a management plan in place for the Southeast fisheries in case the treaty does not come to conclusion this year. We are concerned about the Southern delegation's move to take this treaty to Washington, D.C. and play hardball, their reps against our reps. We believe that, you know, we Alaskans have always tried to keep it in the treaty and come home with their quota as it may be and manage it at home. And we don't mess too much with everybody else in their forums. We don't go to the Pacific Council and lobby that the southern fisheries should be conducted in any particular manner. We don't try to get involved in tribal management of the fisheries. You know, we have been pretty hands-off on other people's management, which I can't say that we feel the same as being afforded to us. We're concerned that the current issue under endangered species of the Snake River fall Chinook salmon is one of these issues under the endangered species that's being taken to the extreme. One of the problems in our industry right now is trying to figure out how to approach the Endangered Species Act, because we really believe it is a good act and we receive a lot of benefits from that act. The health of these stocks is our bread and butter. But when one Chinook salmon, an estimated one fish to the spawning grounds, has the potential of disrupting our entire fishery, and I've got a lot of people on the brink here that are not going to make it with any additional disruption to their fishery. We are very concerned that this isn't allowed to happen, and we don't want to give the impression of not supporting the Endangered Species Act. It is a fairly delicate situation for us. The politics of modeling and the world of science in the treaty isn't always very pure. We had been told that we had a 15% increase in our exploitation rate on these fish. 15% of what is a very important question in my mind to begin with, but now we're hearing maybe we only have a 3% increase in exploitation rate. So the numbers seem to shift around. It's very difficult to get a real handle on this issue, yet it could effectively drive our fishery from here on out. We have encouraged the state to stand tough and not go below a number. The U.S. position in the treaty right now, we think it's very important that the state does not roll prior to the council meeting next month, that we stay firm. We have Commissioner Roche has been exceptionally supportive on this fact. We believe that until the feds tell the state that you must act, that the state is really not obliged to. And then at that point, we hope the state will sit back and take a hard look at it and decide what exactly our action should be. Do we totally disrupt the fishery that feeds 31 communities in Southeast Alaska, and, or do we roll to the Fed? Do we allow that to happen, or do we stand up and the fishermen in the state all go fight the Fed and inform them that there are practical measures that need to be built into this Endangered Species Act? And that's what we hope the state will do, is stand with us on this. We would hate to be in a position of also fighting the state, because we don't believe that anybody in the state thinks that our fisheries should be shut down over one or two fish. We are concerned, I guess if the trollers had some advice to give to the Yukon folks, it would be slow it down on this Yukon negotiation. It's going slow is a wise move. It the things, like I say, the rebuilding program's been exceptionally successful in Southeast, but we are paying for that with the disruption of our fishery, and would hope not to put other fishermen in the state in that same mode. Like any fishery in the state that believes that they are not mixed stock needs to take a real hard look otherwise. Every fishery, unless you're snagging fish off the reds, is mixed stock in some form or another. And the Canadians are just as likely to decide that you need to pass all those fish up as the South is telling us we need to send them all down. We are very concerned about all the fishermen in the state. We think this treaty, without some support from the legislature and Governor Hickel, I think we're in real dire straits on this in this treaty process, and we have grave concerns and are looking to you for some help on this matter. Anything that we can do to get fishermen back to D.C. With the state lobbying, discussing endangered species, discussing the terms of the U.S.-Canada Salmon Treaty is going to be very important to the health of our fisheries. And just as a parting comment, so that you know who our what our fishery is all about, we do have 2,500 permit holders, about 1,600 active permit holders who are 85% resident. They hire about 1,800 additional resident crewmen per year. The impact of our industry, should we be shut down, is, well, we were calculating the other day, if we lost 25,000 fish, that's $1 million ex vessel value alone to our fishery just in Chinook, not to mention what happens if our coho fisheries are shut down, because, you know, we would be shaking these king salmon in the conduct of our coho fishery, and we have real concerns there. And a real conservative dockside estimate is about $9 million worth of coho to the troll fishery each year, not to mention all the spinoff value to the communities. We hold about 75% or greater of the permits in over 20 communities in Southeast. One out of every 25 people works on a troller. And that's just our fishery. Every other fishery in Southeast, most of them are highly resident, employ a lot of residents, land millions of dollars into our state's economy. We are very concerned that the Endangered Species Act is real focused on the troll fishery right now, but it won't remain there. It's a very broad act. Anybody that has a potential of harvesting these fish is at risk, and that's sport and commercial alike, and spans everybody. And I thank you for your time, and anything that I can do to help clarify treaty issues along the way in the months to come, I'd be more than happy to provide information as I can.
Thank you, Mr. Kroll. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, Mrs. Troll, would you like to turn us over?
We sort of have a standing joke. She's supposed to introduce herself as Dale Sane. Once again, my name is Kate Troll, Executive Director of the Southeast Alaska Saners Association. And I'd like to reinforce something that Dale just emphasized, that we certainly believe in our association that the trollers are vulnerable because of the Endangered Species Act. Every fishing group in the state is vulnerable. And that's how we're looking at it. This is an argument to the extreme, particularly when our stocks are so healthy. I went back to D.C. and just tried to bring across the point of the ludicrousy of our fleet is sort of next, the same fleet is next. Now we're looking at a projected harvest of up to 55 million pink salmon this year. You know, 55 million pinks, and you're trying to use this endangered species argument through the treaty as an allocation hammer. It, right now it's all it is for us, but the potential of shutting down 60 million fishery for a stock of concern that is very, very far away. And the really reason why it's such a stock of concern is because of the monster in their own backyard that they don't want to face up to. So it's really easy to look to commercial fishing because we're out there actively, you know, engaged in a taking activity. So the whole state has to be real strong and support the situation right now with the trollers, because if they lose, every other gear group is on the line to lose as well. My role in Pacific Salmon Treaty is one where I just deal with the political fallout. I don't participate in the negotiations. I have other members of our association that do that. And in the last 4 years of, quote, being there for the political fallout, I've not seen anything like I have this year. The intensity is rather overwhelming for me right now. And the situation is such that it's Washington State, as Commissioner Meacham and Dale alluded to earlier. We spend all this time, Alaska and Washington, beating up on each other, and Canada sits there ready to collect the spoils.